Are we rolling, Mike?
We're rolling, Steve. So it's pretty much common knowledge that Blood on the Tracks was recorded in two different locations. What we have as the commercial release that everybody knows is made up of two different sets of recordings, some from Minnesota, some from New York. So what you've done for this bootleg series release is to give people everything that was recorded. Is that what it is?
We've gathered all of the known tapes from the New York and the Minnesota sessions. The New York tapes seem very complete from those 4 days from September 74. And Minnesota, the only tapes known to exist and are locatable are the 5 tracks recorded in Minnesota on multi-track, mixed in New York by Dylan and Phil Ramone. And it's the 5 tracks from Minnesota that were released on Blood on the Tracks, and those are the tapes that we have.
And those tapes were stored where? Those were in Sony's vaults?
In the Dylan vault.
Right. And so the multi-tracks that were used to make those mixes don't exist anymore, to your knowledge.
One more time?
The multi-tracks from Minnesota, all the various...
Well, the multi-tracks of the 5 released tracks that ended up on the real 1975 Blood on the Tracks, we have those multi-tracks.
Oh, okay.
And we have remixed them in the very personal Mr. Dylan in the room sounding mixes that are included in this box. They're the last 5 tracks of the 6 CD box set, and they're mixed in a natural, non-produced type manner, as is the rest of the set.
Oh, well, that's good. So you mixed directly from the multi-track to high-resolution digital.
We transferred all of the original analog tapes high-res, making sure that the speed was right, the azimuth was right, and did a great transfer. And then from high-res digital multi 9624, we mixed 9624.
Okay, and the transfers were done where, using what?
They were done at Sony Studios by Matt Cavalluzzo, gathered by myself, Mr. Rosen, Glenn Corman, Parker Fischel, and then transferred by Matt Cavalluzzo, who's the chief archivist at Battery Studios in New York City.
Okay, and the converter was what?
It's the one I told you before, which now I don't remember.
Pacific Microsonics.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. We can't keep this charade going, so we won't. I'll cop to my mistake. So, but basically, Dylan went into the studio at Phil Ramone's, just him and Phil Ramone, and mm-hmm. and let out these songs, take after take.
They went in on... the box, by the way, is set up in chronological order according to how they were taped. So it starts September 16th, 1974, in an early afternoon session. Bob Dylan by himself. If you see her, say hello, take one, first thing that they did. He was really ready. Just the way that they set them up, just so you know, there's a mic on the acoustic guitar, there's a vocal mic, and there's one mic by the neck, and there's one mic by the sound hole. And then there's one other mic in the room, which is only listed as the safety mic. And it is about 5-8 feet away from the artist. And it was just on all the time. And only if we wanted a little extra room sound did we use those in the mix.
And did that added a little ambiance to it, or a little...
Yeah, it did. It put you more in the room rather than a flatter recording. And that was the goal. The goal was to kind of put you in the room so that Bob Dylan is standing right over there about 8 or 10 feet away from you.
Oh. And did it succeed? Do you get that sense? Is it like the hair on the back of your neck stands up when it starts?
They're very personal and they're very close, and considering the nature of the songs and how he delivered them and the deep feeling he put in them, yeah, it's extremely close. It's very personal, and just to be able to get closer to his performance and his emotion on this music. Different than, and not leveling better worse than the produced album that they made. They made a production that is Blood on the Tracks. These are the tracks.
And how many...
Not the album, Blood on the Tracks.
Right, how many tracks in total is on in this box set?
87, 88.
87 to 88?
87 or 88. Wow. Just a minute, I'll pick up the box. Here's the box. Box is six CDs, and, you know, the first disc has 11 tracks, and the next one has 20 tracks, and the next one has 15 tracks. Disc four has 20 tracks. So.
Okay, so as many people know, after this New York session was done, Columbia rushed out a promo record.
Mm-hmm.
A couple hundred copies got out.
A couple of hundred copies. At the time, proposing the idea that the album would be culled from the 4 days of recording in New York City. Sometime after that, Dylan was in Minnesota around Christmas time, and he decided to re-record some of the songs and do another session. As it turns out, in 1975, what came out, Bob Dylan as the producer, Phil Ramone as the engineer and the mixer, was five tracks from the New York sessions in September and five tracks from the Minnesota sessions.
Now, what prompted him to go to Minnesota and revisit these tracks? He wasn't happy with what he did? Or
I could not project that.
Don't know.
There's been rumors for years as to why. I would suggest you read the liner notes again and read the Clinton Halen to see what their theories are. Right. Certainly at this time, Dylan has not commented on that. He's just presented the music. So I don't know. I mean, the record wasn't out, and records are magic. They're not done till they're done.
Yeah, and so was he or his management upset that somebody released these songs before he was finished?
No, I think it was a purposeful act, an acknowledged act at the time, and then someone changed their mind.
I getcha. And so he's in Minnesota, and he finds a studio that he knew of, or someone sent him to a studio.
I think it's better that you get that type of information from the liner notes.
Okay, yeah, because your job here was to produce this, not to necessarily.
Well, I do, but there's other people who speak about that, and I would like to speak about the music and the recordings and the sound and the process and the final.
Right. But he played with a band in Minnesota.
Yeah. Evidently, he was there, and he was with his brother, and this was discussed, and some musicians were suggested, and some really good players of a local band in Minnesota, and they went in on a couple of days at a Sound 80 Studios in Minneapolis, and re-recorded, what we know of, five of the songs that he had done in New York City, and those are the ones that ended up being chosen to be released on the record.
Wow. And those guys get paid a flat fee, or do they get royalties, or they...
You'd have to call him and ask.
That must be amazing. Someone says, "Hey, Bob Dylan's coming to town. Now, why don't you go in the studio and cut some tracks with him?"
you're a local musician in Minneapolis, and you've been playing at the Holiday Inn and scuffling to get other gigs. And all of a sudden, they go, "Hey, are you available tomorrow to play with Bob Dylan?"
And the first thing they probably says, "What are you, high?"
That's exactly. You're like, "What, are you shitting me? What are you fooling around with me for?" At any rate, they played well. They sound good.
That'd make a great biopic, wouldn't it? That scene.
I'm sure these guys have been asked this question 100 times because musically, in terms of notoriety, they certainly haven't done anything more famous than this.
No, nor would it be likely that they would.
It's my understanding that most of them are living and they get together and they do this sometimes, and it's a thing. It's a thing that they do.
Wow. Okay, so then you went back and you remixed.
We went and got all of the known analog tapes and carefully digitized them to save them, and then we worked from the multi-track digital copies. They sound great. Very, very good job of transferring was done. And then we listened through everything, Mr. Rosen. producer and myself, the producer, and mixed everything with Steve Adabo at Shelter Island Studios in New York City. A wonderful studio with lots of terrific analog gear, beautiful tube EQ at 9624, and went for a natural in-the-room sound, a very personal sound.
So in a situation like this, it's not necessary to try to match the studio sound of New York and Minnesota. In fact, it's probably better to allow each place to show itself, because this is...
Well, we had no intention to try to produce a box set that was reflective of the production of the released record. That decision had been made. They made that record. It's a wonderful record. It's a top 10. It's a top 20. It's on millions of people's Desert Island discs. And that is the way, in 1975, they decided to make that record, produce that record with an ample amount of reverb. And that's how they chose to do it. Phil Ramone using reverb technique that he used sounds very similar to Billy Joel and Paul Simon in productions of the time. Tapes slap into EMT plate, various amounts of that, various speeds of tape, and Mr. Adabo is adept at that, and that's what we did. So we didn't drench it in reverb like a lot of the original mixes. That was not the goal. The goal was to show Dylan performing in the studio and a personal peek into that, and not trying to replicate the original production. Why bother?
Did you use like tube compression just to give it a little pop, or did you just try to leave it?
We didn't use a lot of compression, and we wanted it as natural as possible. It's Neve faders, Neve tube EQ.
Oh.
So, it sounds like what something would have sounded like then, and it sounds great. They used great microphones. It was recorded well to tape. The tapes have held up. The transfers were excellent, and a beautiful quality of sound.
Wow, so you get multiple takes of many songs. And how different were the takes? Did he really try to...
No, he knew these songs before he came in. This was different than, let's say, a lot of the music in the 8 or 10 years before that. Where he was writing quickly, writing on the spot, writing in the studio, these songs were completed and ready to go. If you just put on the first disc and listen to those 12 takes that are the acoustic takes that he does on the first day of recording in the afternoon, they're beautiful. They're gorgeous. He's deep in there. They're magnificent performances. If there was a guy named Bob Dylan and he had only recorded those 12 takes, that would be a legendary recording session. Mm-hmm. He kind of changed the game of what the singer-songwriter was right there. And the passion, the way that he sang them and how he played, they're just magnificent. They're gorgeous.
And so he...
So the very same day, apparently someone has an idea, and again, you probably get a better idea of that through Clinton Halen's book or Jeff Sleet's notes. They decide they're going to get a band. And they bring in a bunch of quality New York City session players.
Because a lot of takes are just him in playing guitar solo.
It starts with Dylan solo, and they probably spend a few hours doing that. And it's set up in the box. And again, you'll see that the first 12 takes of the session on the 16th are CD1, and it's just Bob Dylan vocal and guitar, and that's all. After he does Lily Rosemary and the Jack of Hearts, which has never been out before, this is a version that was not on the album. Oh. The version on the album is the one from Minnesota. This is just him, and it's a majestic marathon take. You know, it's a nine minute, ten minute song, just about.
Wow. You didn't leave any. There's no false starts and mistakes.
Yeah, yes, just before that, there is a you know, before the 9:50, there's a 3:15 breakdown of Lily Rosemary and the Jack of Hearts.
Oh.
Yes, we did. If it was music of quality or illuminating,
yeah.
Interesting, musical, rocking, different words, different chords, if it illuminates the session and his journey through it, it's on there.
Oh.
Including all the really good buttons. It seems as if he was wearing long-sleeve shirts, and they were unbuttoned. And throughout a lot of the session, it's very clear to hear on those great microphones that Phil was using on two and four and strums up. You can hear the button trailing the upstroke of his strum. As a matter of fact, in my notes, I'm looking at the You're a Big Girl Now, take three, which is, I believe, the seventh track on the first CD. In my notes, it says, very good, clean button sound. That happens throughout. I want to point out something to you that what's interesting about this, there's 8 or 10 tracks that are mono, and you can even hear them on the mono takes. When you start to get into, let me see if I can find them, into CD2, on CD2, Idiot Wind, take one, you can even hear in the box set, in some cases, Dylan will say, well, don't keep that, roll over it. What happens is, they have the multi-track running, and they also have a quarter-inch machine running in the back of the room with a mono send from the board. And in some cases, they rolled back over some of the multi-track, but they didn't stop the quarter-inch. We had those tapes as well. So we don't have, for instance, take one, which is not a long track anyway. It's only about 2 minutes long, but it's good. And we don't have it on multi-track because they rolled over it. But we did have it in mono, and there's 8 or 10 tracks like that that we have from the mono, and that does have a lot of reverb in it because he tracked it with a lot of reverb. And so as you go, they stay in chronological order. This was kind of a maze to figure out as to what went where. But fortunately, there usually were slates. And as we're listening through the multi, we'd go, well, wait, there's take one and take four. What happened to take two and three? We don't know. But then, in fact, some of those were on the quarter-inch tapes. Am I making myself clear?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So that was a great find, and it was great that those tapes still existed.
And why did he make those? Why did Phil make those mono board things, do we know?
Maybe it was, you know, I'd like to hear that tonight.
Yeah.
Can I hear that tomorrow? What does that sound like? Can you play that back?
So did you think Bob wore headphones when he was performing or not?
Most likely not.
Yeah, because if he did, he'd hear the button. He might not want to hear that so much. But he heard it in playback, right?
I would never project this way. Yeah, but maybe nobody gave a shit because the performance was so good.
Yeah. Yeah.
Bob Dylan made music, not records.
Yeah, that's true. Now, this is Phil Ramone's A&R Studios? Is that where it was?
Yeah. Which had been a former CBS studio, so Dylan was quite familiar with it.
Right.
By the way, I think there's 8 or 9 of those mono reference mixtapes that are on here, and some of them are great. And you can hear the multi-track tape rewinding and going backwards.
Completing through.
So, oh, that's what happened to that tape. They rolled over it.
Wow. So this is a fascinating thing on many levels, you know, musically and forensically and otherwise.
Even let me see, what did I just notice here? Lily Rosemary and the Jack of Hearts, which did appear on let's call it the New York album, the album that was assembled after the 4 days in November. And there was a release of it, but there was one more verse than that, which they took out when they thought they had finalized it in November to come out as the New York album. They had edited out a verse. My note says it has a 12th verse that's not on the unreleased version.
Oh.
So there are people who have that, and as a bootleg, that was out there, but it wasn't out there with this extra verse, which we found at the end of the multi-track.
And so now it's in there.
We edited it in because it is the complete take of what he did.
And as far as the
and this was approved by the Bob Dylan office.
Right. So they had
we did not vary speed on the final production of the released album of Blood of the Tracks. Dylan and Ramone very speeded up faster a number of the tracks, and we did not do that here because we were not making the production that they were making. We were doing allowing the people to hear what had gone down in the studio as it happened.
So yeah, that's great.
We did not want to speed it up or change the speed or do anything other than what it was.
Right, so it's more of a documentary.
Mm-hmm. But a pretty good sounding one, because Bob played so great and Phil recorded it so well.
Yeah.
So, you know, the raw materials that we had to work with were spectacular.
And you didn't leave much in the way of studio patter in between tracks kind of stuff.
No, we did. We did leave in. We left in a lot more than usual. There's some good stuff. I mean, one of my favorites at the very beginning, I think it's just an understatement. But I think it's at the end of either You're a Big Girl Now or Simple Twist of Fate. Again, I'm sorry I can't remember this. You're sitting in a room, and on the other side of the glass, Bob Dylan is playing Simple Twist of Fate, and the song ends, and there's a silence. And about 8 seconds later, Phil Ramone goes, "That's a good song."
That's good.
And we just left it in with the exact timing that it was.
Yeah. So, just between you and me, and it doesn't really necessarily relate to this, if you're in a situation like that, where he's performing into the microphone and Phil's recording it, but there's still a rapport between the two of them, that a vibe in the studio that gets set up between the two of them, don't you think, in some way?
Well, first of all, he agreed to work with Phil Ramone, so there was something that went on before the moment that it occurred.
Right.
And by this time, they must know one another. These are two well-known people who frequent studios in New York City, and it's not like Phil's a novice.
Yeah.
So they must have known one another, and then the idea of Dylan going back to the studio that he'd worked in before. I can't tell you their relationship. It seems quite formal in the studio, although Phil's fooling around and is talking about getting wine and sending out for corned beef sandwiches.
Good idea.
Some of that's on here. And but Phil's obviously a master engineer. This is nobody needs to talk about that. It's just true.
Yes, it is. So once they decided to bring a band in,
at some point on that same very first day after Dylan does these 12 tracks, they seem to go right into another session of the same tracks with very little explanation to these musicians who are not a band, who have not heard these songs before, and they start playing them.
And they're just supposed to know the chord changes and work through
them? Well, he runs through it and shows them, or he starts to play, and they're supposed to be good enough to follow him. That's what the guys in Nashville did. That's what his regular band did. That's what Bloomfield and Robbie would do.
Yep.
And he wanted to make music, and these people should know how to follow him. That's kind of tough. I can't say that the 20 or so tracks with the band is the highlight of this box set, but it's an interesting journey of he starts alone, he gets a band, and then the next 2 days, he seems to hone in exactly what he wants to do. He keeps the bass player, Tony Brown, brings in Paul Griffin, great keyboard player, to play on it. And they keep going for 4 days. With lots of takes on day one and lots of takes on day four, not so much on day three. And then they think they're done. And then 2 months later, they make these recordings on 2 different days in Minneapolis.
Yeah.
When they get to Minneapolis, it's a 16-track tape. And
what was it in New York?
It was also 16, but they only used 4 or 5 channels. Well, when they got the band, it's 16-track.
Right.
It's 2-inch 16.
A good format.
It's a great format. Well, maybe one of the pinnacle formats.
Yep. You get to 24 tracks, it's too many tracks.
Well, that's your opinion.
Well, it could be too many tracks. I don't know.
Well, when used with taste, it's a great convenience, and you don't have to think about it twice, and if there's more room, more possibilities.
That's true.
And in the hands of really talented people, it can be a bonus.
Right, that's what it takes. Well, it always takes really talented people, one way or another.
True.
And so how long did it take you from start to finish on this production?
Over a year.
Over a year, wow.
To get the tapes, to make sure we had the right tapes, to transfer the tapes, listen to the tapes, figure out how we're going to do it. At the very beginning, Jeff Rosen and Steve Adabo and I did a series of test mixes Should we go this way? Should we go that way? Should we do the reverb? Should we not do the reverb? How do we present the band that doesn't ever get used before the New York musicians?
Right.
What is there on the Minnesota tapes? Is there more or less? What do we add? What do we not add?
And you didn't reference the actual record that came out in
well, we referenced the content. What did they choose to use? What did they choose not to use?
Right.
And we try to go with that. I mean, there's some parts of the recording sessions in New York, you know, like the first version of Simple Twist of Fate. My notes are like, one of the guitars is very out of tune. We mixed it very low in the track. There is no choice but to lean on. There's an electric, there's an electric guitar that has an MX-90 on it. 1974 is just about when the little orange MXR phase box came out.
Right.
And it's a unique sound to hear with Bob Dylan, I'll tell you that. But the acoustic guitar is a little out of tune. There's a nylon string guitar playing, and it's kind of unclear what he's doing. And then the only other full instrument is this real chorusy, phasey electric guitar. So I go, I guess we're going to use that, because that's the way it holds the song and the structure together.
Yeah.
There's a couple of tracks of drums. There's a nylon guitar. There's the electric guitar. There's two mics on Bob's acoustic guitar, and Bob's vocal and bass, drums, kick, and this room safety mic.
Well, like you said, a good opportunity to use what you need to use to get the sound you want. You have enough going on there.
Yep. So, you know, it's got to be tough to walk in the studio with Bob Dylan and not have rehearsed and try to learn these songs, which in some cases are long, and he doesn't necessarily stick to an absolute formula of choruses and verses, spaces in between. And you either feel that or you don't, and it either works or it doesn't. And let's just say it was not optimal on the 17th of September, the 16th of September when they bring this band in. And by the next day, there is no more band. It's just Dylan again, with the bass player.
That's kind of harsh.
Well, they got paid for the session, and I don't know that it's harsh, because the way that the album turned out was great.
That's right.
Now you're going to hear the process of how it got to that.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So, of all the bootlegs that you've produced, where would you rate this one?
Well, they're all different, and I don't know that I would rate them, but, you know, the depth of the performance and the songs are so great, and they were recorded so well. I rank it near the top.
Yeah.
But then again, I'd rank, you know, Royal Albert Hall, which doesn't sound anywhere nearly as good, at the top, and rank Live 75 Rolling Thunder and Philharmonic Hall is turning the world upside down, and Bob Dylan and the band. I mean, where do you go with these? The cutting edge. It's the revolution of 1965 and 66 is unsurpassed.
So how many hours altogether in this bootleg series would you say there, if you were to add them all together, how many hours of music is there? You think there is?
I don't know. Who said we're done?
I'm saying so far. I didn't mean to say you were done.
Well, I don't. I we could just stop and add them up. So I don't know. Some of the boxes are quite large. I mean, and then I get a little confused myself sometimes between the bootleg series boxes. Like, you know, last year we did Bob Dylan and the Band. It's 36 CDs.
Well, yikes.
That was part of the copyright collection. So what do you get there? You got an hour and a half per disc, per show. There you go. You're starting off with 50 hours right there. I'd rather just talk about More Blood and More Tracks.
Yeah, okay. Let's do that.
I'd rather talk about that. Unfortunately, you know, between the Sony archives and the Dylan archives, we had all those tapes except the rest of the Minnesota.
Right. And those tapes,
which I hope someday reappear.
They may be,
no sign of them, and there certainly has been quite an outreach to find them, and nobody has found them. Nor have they been bootlegged. So maybe they're with the Vermeers taken from the Gardner in Boston. I don't know.
You don't know?
No.
But the engineer that did it was still alive?
Yeah, he doesn't have them.
He doesn't know. Wow. He must be kicking himself every night.
I don't know. He did a good job recording it, so that was good to do. I mentioned before that Mick Jagger appears,
right.
which was quite a surprise.
He came over for a corned beef sandwich. Is that really true?
I have no idea what he came over for. That's between them, and without knowledge, as I'm listening through the rough mixes, sort of the faders up mixes we did as we digitized them, all of a sudden, maybe in the morning, on talkback and recorded onto tape, is someone going, slide guitar, and I'm going, why is Mick Jagger there? What is he doing in there? But then again, they know one another. They hadn't just met.
Right.
It's not. They've both been very famous by now for 10 years. Already.
Yes, at least.
He seems to be in there. Dylan seems quite comfortable with him. It's in the box. You can hear that for yourself.
Right.
So that's a lot of fun. What was the song I talked about before with the various versions of keyboard? It's a version of Idiot Wind done on the fourth day. And on the fourth day, Bob said, let me find it in this book. I wish you could have seen this book. It's my workbook of, the production, which looks like the work of a wild man.
Well, it is. I have your pictures of your Beatles thing. It is the work of a wild man. Did you say any?
I copy the lyrics and then make production notes in between them, and everything has gone from bad
to worse. In putting together the vinyl set, you had to cut tracks. How was that? Who did the choice of what?
Well, there's a 6 CD set, and there's a 1 CD.
Oh.
And the one CD is a parallel, basically, of Blood on the Tracks and Up to Me, and it's new, unreleased acoustic versions of Bob Dylan doing those songs, mostly from the first, from the New York sessions, nothing from the Minnesota session.
Oh.
And then the vinyl is a 2 LP set that's the parallel of the 1 CD. So we can put it this way, there's the 6 CD box set, and then maybe you want to call it the best of the box. I have a copy of that here, too. It's actually called... It's just called Bob Dylan, More Blood, More Tracks, the Bootleg Series, Volume 14. And that's what it's called, and it is 11 tracks. And those 11 tracks are in the box set, which is More Blood, More Tracks, the Bootleg Series, Volume 14, Deluxe Edition. So, I think it's pretty stunning to listen to this parallel single disc version, and the vinyl is the same tracks broken up into, very nicely spaced 2 LP set,
right.
Cut from the same 9624, mixed by Adabo and me and Rosen, mastered by Mark Wilder, and then cut, the vinyl was cut by Ryan.
Right. Good combination of people. So then if you get that and you really dig it, then you can go buy the CDs just so you have everything. That's a good way to do it. It's a sampler.
It's also a way in this day and age of non-retail. So if there's a big Bob Dylan fan and they want to buy this box, they can go get this box for whatever it costs, $60, $70, or $80. I could look it up.
Right.
But if you're not that into it, or you just want the parallel sequel to the record that you can get the single disc.
Yeah. I like that.
You can spend $10 as opposed to $70.
Right.
Now, if you and I were out there buying them, we would certainly buy the big one because we want it.
That's right. I would do that. I would get the vinyl, and then I would get the big thing to have everything. That's what I would do.
Yeah, and the vinyl looks beautiful. Actually, the graphics of the whole thing, done again by Jeff Gans. I wanted to talk about, for instance, in the box, the version of Idiot Wind done on the 19th. Dylan plays it. Now, the one that's on Blood on the Tracks is an Idiot Wind that was done in Minnesota. And so people heard this version of Idiot Wind from September, except a version of this, which I think is called Take 4, was on the proposed New York album. And on it, it had organ playing. So what it seems like had happened is that Dylan performed by himself and then had Paul Griffin, great keyboard player, played on, like, you know, Sooner or Later.
Right.
Beautiful, one of the greatest New York City musicians, session guys, piano, organ of all time. Magnificent player with Paul Simon and hundreds of other people. It's incredible that Paul Griffin wasn't famous, and many people relied on him. He could hear and listen and figure it out in just minutes and just be a great, tasteful musician. So he's obviously called in on the 19th, and among the things that he plays is on Idiot Wind. And on the proposed New York album, they use what I call Pass Number 3, that has a very windy, wild, kind of spooky, sporadic, whirly sound. And when we listened to it, we thought, okay, well, you know, there's another part that he does just before that, which we call Pass 2. It's kind of much more like Booker T and seems more fitting to the song. So in the box set, what we chose to do was put the solo version of Dylan Alone immediately followed by the exact same take with what I'll call more tasteful organ on it.
Hmm.
And if people really want to find the other one, it did come out with the swirly organ, and it has been bootlegged out there for many years. But we chose not to do that because that was not a take that they chose to put out. And we thought it was interesting to put the original solo pass on and then the organ, which seemed more tasteful. Because there's actually three passes at the organ, and the first one is kind of Booker T-ish. The second one is a little, someone got the idea we should make it more wild and more swirly. And then the third one, he only plays through parts of it, and it is no longer swirly. It's still kind of more laid back again. So
who makes those decisions, do you think? You don't know, so what's the point of pushing
it? Who makes what?
Do a swirly organ, do not a swirly organ?
Well, that was musicians in a studio. That was, I would imagine, that Dylan had recorded it, and then Griffin comes in, and they said, here, listen to this, play on this. Put the thing on, and Griffin plays. He plays it once, he plays it twice.
Oh, yes, it's just overdubbed anyway, so it doesn't matter.
And then they go, okay, I think we got it. And then, you know, they made a decision on the proposed New York album, which then never came out. And that's what we tried it one way, two ways, three ways, four ways. We tried them all, and the decision came back from the Dylan office to have it be the acoustic Bob solo version and then the one with the kind of more traditional R&B-ish organ on it.
Now, when you're working on a project like this for a year, do you get to a point where you say you got to take a break because you sort of get lost in the thicket of it and you lose perspective, or can you just keep pushing through it?
It's a team of people, and I trust Adabo on the technical side. And though I know a lot about the technical side, I'm not plugging things in and patching things. And he is.
Right.
And then with regards to all final decisions, they come from the Bob Dylan office, and I'm able to work on it and make suggestions and try mixes and send them in and. And then decisions get made. I can't always tell you the process because I don't actually know, which is amazing after nearly 30 years of doing it.
Yeah. I guess that's
if you're an engineer producer and you get to work on music and material as elevated and spectacular as this, you're a very lucky person.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you have, on that basis, you've had tremendous luck for decades now working on some of the greatest recordings ever made and some of the greatest artists. I don't think there's a higher endorsement you could possibly have.
I've hoped growing up that I could be associated with music that was great, and here we are doing that.
Yeah, it's, you can't deny it now. You know, it's undeniable.
I'm not denying nothing other than I hope to work with, you know, just a little inspirational side. Growing up, you look and you go, who's Phil Ramone, and who's Van Gelder, and who are these people?
But you're paying attention to that, because it matters to you, so, you know, not everybody
does. Who are
does.
These guys? Or you'd go, oh, I don't know, you'd go, geez, this is an Al Schmidt record, I bet that sounds good.
Yes, you gravitate to those. You look on the back of a record, and you go, oh, I know that guy, he makes good-sounding records, I'll try.
You know, a coincidence here, you'd go, ooh, a Tom Wilson record, I should hear this Mother's record, oh, I should hear this Velvet Underground record.
Right.
Who does that? What does that mean?
Exactly.
And I thought maybe one day I can be a guy where people go, hey, we should listen to it. He worked on it.
Yeah, well,
because all I care about is bringing out the most of what it is that the artist and the engineer and producers were going for in the first place.
And you did that. You've done that.
Still going, baby. Still don't going. Write me off yet.
No, I'm not. I'm not writing you up. You're not on my taxes, you know. So, is the next project?
You did once do comedy, didn't you?
Yeah, I did.
Anyway,
is the next? Well, it's like I told you. I ended the Beatle review. I said that the record has been Martinized, but it won't take you to the cleaners. Mm-hmm. People thought that was funny.
I think that you should have figured out how to sanforize it too.
Yes, well, that would be for a comedy album with Red Fox. So, do you have the next project in mind yet? Is that on the horizon?
They don't come from my mind.
Well, have they given you the assignment yet? How does it work? They call you and say, Steve, our next millionaire. Is it like that?
I meant to win the Mega Millions the other night.
Me too.
I just want you to know that. So we're still working here. No, I can't. It's how the decisions get made, I don't know. And there's nothing to report yet about an Xbox. Because nothing is scheduled to come out except for this right now. So what gets scheduled is another matter, and there could be any number of releases, boxes set that are in any number of states of not researched or completely mastered, and when it's not a press release, when it's time for that to come, the Dylan office and then Sony will report on that.
Right. Okay. Well, this time I got it. I have to have gotten it. The red light
is on. Could I have been an international spy that you can't get information out of me?
Yes, you're very closed-lipped. Not closed-minded, but closed-lipped.
No, that's because it's not my job to decide that. It's Bob Dylan's job.
That's right. And when you have a guy like Bob Dylan making the decisions, you don't want to be making them for him.
he did pretty well before Berkowitz showed up.
But you've done... Listen, you've taken the legacy and the decades of great art, and you have assembled and compiled them in a way that he has to be grateful for what you've done, whether it tells you that or not. I'm telling you on behalf of him. So I don't work for him, so I can be that presumptuous.
Well, thanks for saying so. I'm just happy to keep doing them and to be involved. And sitting there, you know, holding the tapes is the same as anyone else who's ever wanted to be a musician in production. It's a treat. It's an honor.
Yep.
Every once in a while I go, what the hell did I get in here?
And there's no doubt that holding a tape in your hand is not the same as holding a file on a stick in your hand. There's no doubt.
Well, I don't. If it's the original and it's the source, it's or as John Hammond would call it, it. When it is the thing, when it is great, when it will be released, he would call it it.
Yeah, I get that.
So whatever it is, whether it's, you know, on acetate or tape or Pro Tools, if it's it, it's it.
Yep.
As much as I care about the sound, I don't care about the production, but I do care about the production. It's the feel, and it's how do you transport the moment of creation to the listener. It's that journey. That's I'm a shepherd.
Huh. Well, that's right. That's good. And it was great talking with you, and great getting you on recording this time. It's good.
I hope so.
Me too.
All right, Matt. Talk to you soon.
Okay, bye.